Accession number 30639, Mr. Alan Davis, a real 10. Now, we're talking about your time flying Hurricane 2Cs with a number 11 advanced flying unit at Calvary. And you were talking about your first solo, and you had to do a right-hand solo thing, which was just
right-hand,
a bit strange.
Right-hand circuit,
yeah. Just a bit strange, you were saying. It's like, continue.
Well, that was about it. That was the only strange bit about it. The first solo went like a dream. It was like my first solo in the Stearman and the Tiger Moth.
Now, what was it like? What was it like to fly a Hurricane? I mean, you know, people don't know it, now. Very few people.
It was a magnificent feeling of freedom. You sat in the cockpit. You taxied out to the end of the runway. You did your cockpit check before you on the edge of the runway, and then you turned down the runway, and there's a big stretch of dead straight road, if you like, ahead of you, and you shove the throttle forward, and the engine picks up full power, knocks your head back onto the headrest due to the initial and terrific acceleration, and before you know where you are, you're doing 50 or 60 miles an hour down the runway, and the aeroplane is itching to get off, even a heavy aeroplane like a Hurricane, and with no bother at all, it eases itself off.
Any problems of veering, no, because I think the Spitfire did.
The Spitfire did. Now, this particular Hurricane was very much more gentle, and as long as you got the trim tabs correctly adjusted. You had a forward and fore and aft trim, so you can make it nose heavy or nose or tail heavy. That's the fore and aft trim. It's a wheel, really, and then you have a separate wheel which stops you veering left or right. So you put on whatever rudder it is, 1.5 turns or something of the left and right trim tab, and if you've got it right, the Hurricane, as far as I remember, took off with very, very little pressure required on the rudder pedals at all. If you've got the adjustment of the trim tabs right, it just took itself off, and from then on, it's completely freedom, as long as you remembered to pull the undercarriage up, and it was a simple movement, but you had to change hands. The chap who invented this system obviously was ambidextrous, because you the controls for the undercarriage, and I think the flaps probably too, but certainly the undercarriage, were on the right hand side, and you steered normally with the right hand on the control column and left hand on the throttles, so you had to change over. You had to release the throttles, grab the stick with your left hand, and move your right hand down to somewhere by your knees was the the lever for putting the undercarriage up. And you could usually tell people on their first solo, because having just got off the ground, the plane rocked fore and aft, because you were completely unused using the control column with your left hand. So once the undercarriage was up and you changed back to normal right-handed movement, it all was well again. But that slight dipping of the nose and raising of the nose whilst the hands got the feel of it. So you could, as I say, easily tell somebody who was on his first or second solo. But it didn't happen after that. You got used to the idea and all was well. And then I do remember on my first solo, first solo in the Hurricane, I realised that before I took off that I had no idea how it felt and the controls felt when you throttled back and had flaps and wheels down. So there was nobody around in the bit of sky that I had chosen to go to. One always chose a direction to fly in. In other words, you either flew north, south, east, or west, or whatever, conscientiously and consciously, so that you knew how to get back back again. I mean, if you took off and you didn't aim to go north, south, east, or west, or whatever, you could easily get yourself lost. And, you know, you'd be flying for 10 minutes and you'd be, 50 or 60 miles away from the airfield in no time at all. So having worked that out mentally, I found myself a little friendly-looking cloud at about 2,000-3,000 feet up. So that was a safe height. And I flew over it and then climbed 800 feet above it and then did a dummy circuit onto this cloud. And on my final approach down to this cloud, I put the wheels down and the flaps down. And so I could feel how the aircraft reacted and how it felt to have wheels and flaps down, because it's quite a different sort of an aeroplane with all those things hanging down underneath it. So I cracked it. As far as I was concerned, I knew how it felt. So I whipped the flaps and the undercarriage up again and went off and did my stuff wherever, like spinning or aerobatics or whatever it was you'd been biffed to do.
Now, what was she like to handle? I mean, because people always say the Spitfire was easier to handle in, or more of a thoroughbred in the air. What was the Hurricane like to handle, as far as you were concerned?
Well, it was just like a Harvard, instead it was a heavier aircraft, and it responded like a slightly heavier aircraft. It took more effort to get it into a steep turn, for example, because it had it was heavier and it had a bigger and more powerful engine. But it responded just like any other aeroplane. But when I compare it later on with a Spitfire, the Spitfire was so much more sensitive, the Hurricane. And after all, these were fairly elderly old ladies that we were allowed to fly around the sky in. So they weren't in tip-top, as new condition. They had been bashed around a fair bit for quite a number of years by clumsy people like myself. So, but apart from slight deficiencies in everything being fairly well worn, it was an absolutely charming aeroplane to fly. It did all that you had ever hoped it would do. And it wasn't certainly not difficult as such to fly, having had all that several hundred hours worth of instruction. So it was great fun to fly, and one felt very proud and very well proud of oneself at having achieved that particular goal.
So after that first solo, would you then fly a bit? What would you move on to in the Hurricane? Would you practice formation flying in Hurricanes?
Yes, formation flying, and then...
And what was it like for formation flying? I mean...
Well, again...
Or was it just the same as a Harvard?
Well, very similar to Harvard. I mean, it's exactly the same technique, but you had to get used to how much more powerful the engine was, so the very slightest adjustment of throttle brought you back into position, for example, if you lagged behind, or... If you pushed the throttle too far forward and over accelerated, you very soon overshot your station in a formation flying.
So if you're a bit ham-fisted with a throttle, you'd have trouble keeping formation.
Well, that's what some people obviously found, but that was all cured long before you got your wings. If you were too ham-fisted, you didn't get too far.
So it was just a matter of getting used to the Hurricane rather than... you'd already got throttle control,
yes.
It's just a different throttle.
It's just getting used to flying a different sort of aeroplane. And we also did low-level formation flying. And I can well remember, perhaps this wasn't as it should have been, but there was one instructor, he was leading a formation of three. And we were so low in the low-level flying, formation flying, that we were heading for a group of trees, and we had to each bank our aircraft into a almost 90-degree attitude to make sure the wings didn't hit the trees. And I found that exciting. I thought that was great fun. And I thought it was just absolutely superb fun to fly. And if you've got an instructor like that who was a bit of a... didn't exactly obey the rules, and I'm sure the rules were that you shouldn't do that at an advanced flying unit. But he taught us a great deal.
Now, did he move on to tactics or you know...
No, this was still an advanced flying unit. It wasn't until the operational training unit that you've
got. This is still just flying.
Yep.
The nuts and bolts of what you do when you did go
through. The nuts and bolts. You're learning to fly a more powerful and supposedly more difficult aeroplane.
So no photography or anything like that either?
No. Again, all that came at operational training unit.
Anything else you were doing? So you've got formation flying, low-level flying, in formation. Anything else that was newish?
No, that and I think night flying. Night flying, we'd done that in the Harvard, I suppose, before VE Day. Because before VE Day, when everything was blacked out, night flying in this country really was difficult. Because you took off, and once you'd taken off, you really didn't see another light until you got back to the airfield, where there was a big red signal light, which in Morse code indicated which airfield it was. So we did some night flying in Hurricanes, which again was not too much, because with Hurricane and the Spitfire, with these... very big exhausts either side of the engine. The glow and sparks and things which came out of the exhaust pipe tended to blind you and make visibility much more difficult. So the night flying was probably limited to dusk flying rather than night flying. But the flying the Hurricane was the big stride forward. That was a big leap from having always had dual in a plane before. So your first solo took place with no dual instruction, and that was a great stride forward. So,
now how long were you at Calverley? You got there in April, you say?
Yep, got there in April, and.
Into May, obviously.
Yes, May, at the end of May. 31st of May. Hurricane and Harvard.
Now, what happens next then? What was mess life like at the Calverley? I mean, because it's your first officer's mess, really.
Yes, it was.
You had a bit of a one at Harrogate, but...
Yes, well, that was minor, yes, certainly. Now, that I found existing in the mess was no bother at all. And we had a certain amount of ground school at the advanced flying unit. And I remember...
Now, hang on, stick to the officer's mess. Yep. So what was the officer's mess like, if you remember?
Well, it was nothing outstanding. It was a very much a wartime airfield, and it's certainly an airfield no longer. It's an industrial estate these days. But they were the usual wartime... it wasn't a Nissen hut, but it was a flat-topped a wartime type building. I think it was built on an H... The plan was sort of an H plan, because you had... you walked into the reception and you had the officer's mess on the one side and the dining room on the other. As I remember, the food wasn't bad at all. And we had we weren't bossed around very much because we were all pilot officers and treated as just young SPROG officers. But I can't remember anybody throwing their weight about there or being unpleasant to us.
What was the drinking and social life like?
Affable. We certainly, at Calverley, there was a pub on the canal side, which we used to go to quite frequently, or now and again, let's say. And I remember on VE Day itself, some NCO at this pub with a pair of scissors, and all he did, he went round to all the pilot officers and cut their ties off just below the knot. So you had this tie around your neck with no tail, as it were, and it didn't seem to matter very much on the, whether it was 6th or 9th of May.
8th of May.
8th of May. 8th of May. It didn't seem to matter very much.
Funnily enough, we got talking about your reactions to VE Day. I forgot to ask, what do you remember of that celebration, as opposed to how you reacted to it? But there was a celebration at that pub that night. What do you remember of it?
I do remember that when the news broke through, as it were, and we were and officially declared that the war was over, I was actually playing cricket for the station against, well, perhaps it was an interstation game, I don't remember. I do remember the game, in as much as I do remember making an absolutely outstanding fielding performance, where the ball was belting past me towards the boundary, and I stuck out a hand, and the ball stuck in my hand, and I threw it back fairly accurately to the wicketkeeper, and I hope the bloke was run out. But I do remember that particular incident, and I remember because we all had to play in borrowed gear, because nobody had any white trousers or white shirts or whatever, so you had to stores, you usually produce these sort of things, and I remember my trousers wouldn't stay up very well, my borrowed white trousers, which didn't fit very well, and I don't remember how many runs I made or even whether the game finished, because somebody said the war is over and from the boundary, and I think we all lost interest in the game from then on. And so from then on, the whole of the station was in a, if you might, say, in a party mood, because all the rules were broken. You know, everything went wild. I remember extremely well, a WAF got hold of the group captain's cap, which one that had scrambled egg all round the brim. And he obviously parted company with it, the strict instruction that he would get it back next day. But this WAF wore this group captain's hat the whole of the evening. And I don't know why I should have remembered particularly, because I wasn't in that particular drinking party. But all the pubs were open, of course, and rejoicing, and the mess was serving the drinks all the evening. We were wonderful chaps, that the bar staff remained on duty all this time. I don't know how or why they persuaded people to work like that, but the beer flowed a bit fluidly that particular night.
And then you went to the pub as well?
Well, I'm sure we went to the pub as well.
Cut the ties off.
Yes. And the sergeants weren't in the officers' mess at all, even though it was VE night. But they were very prominent in the local pub with these scissors. And it was all right if you had another tie, because otherwise it was a bit difficult to make, you know, because you wore a tie even with battle dress, and you had to have something black around your neck. So I guess most of us had another tie tucked away somewhere, but which we produced the next day. But I remember carrying this short length of tie around with me for several months afterwards as a memento of the occasion. And next day everything sort of went back to normal. And certainly our flying went back to normal, because within 24 hours we were back on our normal routine of flying.
Now, you finished there 31st of May. Where did you go next?
Well, to my disappointment, they were sent to yet another advanced flying unit instead of going directly to an operational training unit.
Now, which one was that?
And I was sent then to an airfield at Atcham, which is near Shrewsbury.
Atcham,
A-T-C-H-A-M, which is quite near Shrewsbury.
So that's Shropshire.
Shrewsbury in Shropshire. And I didn't enjoy that half as much.
Do you remember the number?
I'm looking for it. Yep. I then went to Atcham, which is number 5 brackets P advanced flying unit.
And what were you flying there?
Again, they're supposed to be Harvards and Spitfires, but I never got round to the Spitfire because I was only there from the 10th to the 10th of July until the 26th of July.
So that puts another month gap.
Yeah, another month gap. And all I flew...
It's not June, is it? Because you left on the 31st of May, I thought you said.
Yes. According to my logbook, I left on the 31st of May.
So then there's a month out before you join the number 5 in July.
Yep. I don't know quite what happened in that month.
Now, why were you there? What was the point of this?
Well, I just can only think it was delaying tactics, so to speak, because there was no room at the operational training unit, because it was just a waste of time. All I did was fly a Harvard again.
And not much, either.
And not very much. What was that? 2, 4, 6... About... 15 or 20 times I flew in the whole of the time I was at Atcham, and I was pretty bored. So, let's cross over.
Did you get to see the Spitfires at all? Or
No. I may have sat in one, but I certainly didn't fly one.
So what next? You're there in July.
Well, I now see in my logbook, which I especially... I especially made a note of, that from the 26th of July, I did 3 separate trips of a curved approach.
Now that's
a fighter technique of I thought we had done it in the Hurricane, but I certainly didn't put it in my logbook.
But now tell me about the curved approach. What is the curved approach?
Well. Normally, when you're flying, you do these crosswind and downwind and so on legs, and then your crosswind leg where you line up with the runway, and then on your final approach, you do a straight in approach, like the big aeroplanes do at Heathrow and other big major airports. They make a straight approach, they line up with the runway, and they just trundle in. And land on the runway. Now that is because the pilot has a completely free view out of his nose of the cockpit and can see the runway and all the signals or whatever he might be receiving from either side of the runway. But with a curved, with a fighter airplane, and you've got a socking great engine in front of the cockpit, in the Hurricane and certainly much more so in the Spitfire. You can't see a thing straight ahead because of this great big engine. And with the Spitfire, the later marks of the Spitfire, it was a very big spread of engine. So you were taught how to do a curved approach, which means that you fly on the downwind leg, and the runway is therefore parallel to you, but you're flying downwind. You turn in and you keep your wing, left-hand circuit, your left-hand wing more or less pointed at the end of the runway. And you do a long, curved, gentle turn to the left. And if you judge it right, you're lined up with the runway when you've reached what, 100 feet, 200 feet perhaps, and you then start to lose sight of the runway. And so you're looking with a curved approach, you can see the runway right down until the last couple of hundred feet. So you then straighten up, and you know that the runway is straight ahead, and as long as you can't see the edge of the runway, you know you're going down, you're lined up going down the runway. But it means if there's another aeroplane stuck on the runway, you wouldn't see it. So that's how accidents can occur. Luckily, it didn't happen to me. But that's when you start learning a curved approach. At least I had forgotten that the very late stage of the training, I started doing that. And they were great fun to do later on, because you literally did just that. You stuck your wing, lined up your wing, left-hand wingtip with the end of the runway, and just screeched round into a lovely, with power assisted, but descending turn. You're turning all the time and you're losing height all the time. And if you're not losing height quick enough, you sideslip towards the ground, which to any passenger would give them the willies. But you know, you don't have a passenger, and you're perfectly in command of what you're doing. And so you finish up, as I say, lined up with the runway. And when you've got fairly confident in the Spitfire later on, you could make really quite spectacular curved approaches. And they were great fun to do, and very satisfying if they worked out right. The danger is, of course, if you get down to the runway height and you're not lined up with the runway, and you've misjudged it. If you kick at a slow speed, if you kick left or right rudder, you can stall the aeroplane. Even a ladylike aeroplane like a Spitfire will flip over on its back. And that's no position to be in at 100 feet above the concrete. So there is a certain amount of skill and judgment in getting this right.
How do you do a sideslip? You mentioned the sideslip. We didn't mention that. What is a sideslip?
A sideslip.
People don't do it now.
Well, yes, it's something you do quite often if you want to lose height. You stick the one wing down, say the left hand wing down, and then you kick left rudder, so that the aeroplane, instead of travelling straight ahead and you get full lift from the air going over the wings, your nose has swung, if you like, to the right, and you are travelling down somewhere an angle between the wing and the nose of the plane. So you are rapidly losing height, but completely under control. And that's the sideslip. And you wouldn't do that near the ground unless you jolly well had to, because there always is a possibility of one of the wings, over which the air is not flowing as it should do, you lose the lift and the wing stalls. So that's a sideslip.